This episode of Scene Report is brought to you by White Label Yerba Mate Soda. Launched out of Brooklyn's legendary Bossa Nova Civic Club in 2016, White Label Yerba Mate Soda is a beloved staple of New York City dance floors and nightlife. This revitalizing local energy drink has 80 milligrams of naturally occurring caffeine per bottle and is a perfect cocktail mixer for various spirits and an excellent NA menu option. You can actually mix this with tequila, vodka, gin, even whiskey. Tastes amazing. If you've ever gone clubbing in Berlin and seen people drinking club mate, this is like a better tasting version of club mate. It is much less sweet, much more balanced. I personally quit drinking coffee like 5 years ago because I actually couldn't really deal with the intense highs and lows and the crash that would happen like an hour after I had a cup of coffee. I actually just drink yerba mate and tea now, and I find that that just gives me like a much more even energy throughout the day without any of the crash. And even if you do still drink coffee, which a lot of people do, you can still drink White Label yerba mate soda. White Label is like the best version of this. It's a soda technically, but it is not very sweet. It's bubbly. It tastes awesome and you just feel great. And it can just be like a regular thing that you like drink throughout the day, or it can be the type of thing that you like drink it when you're out at the club, when you're trying to like hang out. I love White Label. I have been drinking this since it came out. It's an awesome product. It's available at a bunch of bars, venues, clubs, bodegas, whatever in New York City. If your cafe, restaurant, venue is interested in serving an amazing drink that's also kind of the coolest drink in New York, you can go to whitelabelmate.com. That's whitelabelmate.com to see about getting this awesome product in your space. Or if you're just a customer like me, look out for it or ask the places that you're going to if they'll serve White Label Yerba Mate Soda. White Label Yerba Mate Soda is the best way to get the party started or keep it going. Welcome, listeners, to season one, episode one of Scene Report with Johnny Hummus. I am your host and producer, Reed Dunley. I used to do a podcast called Protest and Survive. That pod is still like in the feed up in here if you want to go check out old episodes. I also was a DJ at WFMU, if you ever heard of that one, in Jersey City, at Newtown Radio in Brooklyn, at Radio CPR, a pirate radio station in Washington, D.C., at WRPI in Troy, New York. What up, my upstate homies? But now I'm doing this thing. And, you know, I've been toying around with the format of this whole show, or this whole pod, as people call it in 2023, trying to not sound like too much of a millennial cusp boomer over here. But I am of the ethos that this is... This is really going to be a live-to-tape situation. This is going to be radio style. This isn't going to be super edited and slick and, annoying to make. But at the same time, I've been talking to people. I've been thinking about this thing, and we're going to give it a shot. I'm going to try to introduce this episode a little bit. That might change next episode, but it might change in three episodes, four, five. But for now, I'm going to give it a shot. Johnny Hummus is somebody that came onto my radar right around when he was moving to New York a couple years ago. I saw that he was like making hummus and selling it on Instagram or something like that. I met him at a show at TVI in Ridgewood, Queens, at a punk show. I was like, bro, ain't you the Johnny Hummus guy? Like, what is good with you? And then like, about a week later, I had just seen this unnamed jam band that I like sometimes perform at Madison Square Garden. And me and my homie who went to the show, which that was a wild show. After the show, we decided to get a bite to eat in K-Town, Koreatown, Midtown Manhattan, like right up the road from the venue. Sitting out in front of this Korean restaurant at like midnight, 1 a.m., something like that. And like the crew walks by. My old homie from Florida, Miami, Boots. The homie Alex, who had like just moved here from Philly. And then Johnny Hummus, like roll up. And they're like, hey. I was like, yo, what's good, my friends? Like, what are you guys doing in Midtown? They had just been outside of Jeffrey Epstein's house, just like for funsies, like doing some New York City sightseeing, his like mansion uptown somewhere, Upper West Side, I'm assuming. And they, those guys sat down at the table with us because they're like, we're looking for somewhere to eat. And I was like, why don't you eat with us? We're like on the street about to order this food. We got pitchers of beer coming. We're chilling. My friend who I was at the show with, like, was a big fan of Johnny Hummus, of the stuff that he does on the internet. So he was like totally starstruck. And we got into some wild shenanigans after that in Midtown, after the Fish concert. We don't really need to talk about that here. But I was like, yo, I like this guy, Johnny. Like, I want to know more about this guy, right? And like, you know, the best part about doing journalism for me, like, I've been interviewing artists and bands and just like all sorts of other people once I started doing journalism professionally. But like the best part of doing like kind of like fan based journalism, like I used to put out a fanzine, used to do all these radio shows, whatever. It's just like I get to like ask an artist that I am interested in whose art or music or whatever that I fuck with. I get to ask them like a whole bunch of probing questions about their life and like get to know them over the course of like 45 minutes to an hour and a half, however long we ramble for. And like, yeah, I was like, I was super curious about what Johnny's deal was. Like he played in some metal bands in Orlando, Trash Bag, Human, Zoavitz. He had just moved to New York, but he was playing in this band. I saw their first show at the Bowery Ballroom opening for Special Interest. They were called Pure Terror. They had some people who played in some other bands that I really liked, most notably Haram. It was like an all, or is, not was, it's an all Arab American punk band from like backgrounds in different countries from that part of the world. And I was like, yo, this band slaps. I'm about this band. They're good. Saw them play a bunch more times, getting to know those people better. Had done some journalism with a bandmate of his about some weird stuff that the FBI NYPD Joint Terrorism Task Force did with him because they were confused about what he was singing about in Arabic in his old band called Haram. And like, and then we got Johnny here, you know, strolling down the street midnight in K-Town looking for a bite to eat and down to like get weird. But like, you know, Johnny's like he's a Palestinian American Floridian. He spent a lot of time with his family back in Palestine when that was a thing that he could do at different points throughout his young life. And like, he's making these videos up on Instagram Reels or whatever, just like talking mad shit about people, mostly white people, people like me, making hummus on their own TikToks. And he's just like, yo, what are you doing? Please stop. And it's funny, but it's like also not funny. Because it's like actually about something. You know, Johnny talks about like hummus being like the story of his people and like a given that other people have a weird relationship with hummus at the grocery store when they buy Sabra hummus or Tribe or Cedar or whatever fucking Brooklyn hummus company has popped up, but he's been eating hummus that his mom made and his family made and now that he makes for his whole life. And he has a much, much different relationship to that food, right? So I'm going to let the man speak for himself because he's got a lot of better shit to say than I do. But, you know, he's a thoughtful guy. He's a smart guy. He's doing something that seems kind of silly, but it's actually kind of subversive and important. Kind of makes you think. But he's also like a punk and like a metalhead. And that's like my sort of world and my scene. So like, I felt like Johnny was kind of like the best episode one homie to come and do this podcast thing, because it kind of speaks to all this stuff I'm trying to do with this podcast, which is like interview artists and interview people who are making art, music, content, whatever, but doing it in like a new way and a subversive way and in a way that's part of a counterculture. And they're saying something about the world while they're doing it, but like at the same time, like the art they're making, whether that art is like a bowl of hummus or that art is like a lit drum beat for his punk band, is like something that I appreciate. So we brought Johnny Hummus on the show. I'm going to quickly say that this episode was actually recorded on July 23rd, 2023. So we're going to do something that we're probably not going to do a whole lot on the show, is we're actually going to do like a little like pre-interview. That's not really the word. We're going to do like a preface. Me and Johnny are getting back together like very soon before you're going to hear this episode, if you're listening to it when it comes out, because right now it's early December. And we're pushing like 2 months of a, I guess you could call it a war. People would also call it a genocide, of like a really fucked up thing happening in the world that relates pretty directly to Johnny's life and Johnny's family's lives. And so it just didn't seem to really make sense to like put this episode up from an interview we did a couple months ago, as I'm kind of getting this podcast together, without like actually talking a little bit about what has happened in the world. Of course, we're talking about other stuff about Palestine that makes a whole lot of sense in the context of the last 75 years of a people not having their own nation state and having to live in occupied land in whatever way they can get by. So like a lot of the shit we're talking about in this episode is like super relevant either way, and it's gonna be super relevant either way for some time. But me and Johnny see each other out in the streets in New York City. We've been working on stuff together out in the streets in New York City. Hopefully I've been seeing some of you, my listeners, out in the streets. You know, on your social media is a good start, but you know, out in the streets is like what it's about, or whatever you're doing is what it's about. But like doing something in real life, I think is pretty important. So before we get to the proper episode, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what's happened in the last couple months for the people of Palestine, for the people in New York City, which is where we live. And honestly, it's an honor and a privilege to have Johnny coming on and talking about what's going on in his life. That's no small feat. We're like, you know, he's got shit going on right now. So taking the time to come and talk about that, I appreciate for sure. So this is my little experiment on doing an intro for the show. I'm not really going to edit this. I'm going to run it live to tape. We are motherfucking live right now recording this thing. You know, not live, you're hearing it later, but me, I'm live, you know, radio style, radio ready, live to tape. Let's go. So without further ado, the man, the myth, the legend, for a free Palestine, Johnny Hummus, On Scene Report, Season 1, Episode 1, let's go. Johnny Hummus.
In the flesh. What up, Reed?
In the flesh.
Allah, Allah.
In the kitchen.
In the kitchen. Something's cooking always.
Always something cooking. Johnny.
Fuck.
What's up with your life right now?
Dude, so much shit. It's like, you know, it's interesting being alive, right? There's so many normal stressors that you just have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And then there's the worldly stressors that seem insurmountable and surmounting more every day. And right now, obviously, there's a siege on the siege and the bombardment of Gaza, which has been taking a toll on me and everyone I know, really. But as a Palestinian, it's been a lot for, like, you know, a myriad of reasons, including just like the, you know, it's not to make it about. It's not about me. It's really not. I'm not from Gaza. I don't know anyone in Gaza, actually. You know, my family's from the north. But at the same rate, it's like, you know, I am Palestinian. I've been Palestinian my whole life. And thus, it's just like knowing. It's like a secondary loss of innocence. Like, you know, I lost my innocence a long time ago. But it's to lose it again, to be reminded that the world doesn't see your value as a human. You know what I mean? And that's like not just on a personal level. It's like, you know, the entirety of Palestinians. It's just what it's not that I don't believe the people of the world are in support. But, you know, the governments and the powers that be, you know, that's the operational fucking paradigm. You know, Palestinian lives don't matter. So every day when I wake up and when I go to sleep, I think to myself, what can I do to change this? What can I do for my people and the world? Because obviously all these struggles, all struggles are interconnected, you know? So it's just been a lot. So that's just, but juggling life and juggling these huge problems that, you know, many people have been speculating on for years on how to resolve them. And not, I don't believe a single person could do it. I know Johnny Hummus isn't the answer, you know, to everything, but it's every day is thinking about what's my part in this and how can we turn the tide, you know?
Have you come up with any good answers?
It's really tough, to be honest. And I mean, currently the biggest, I mean, this is what Johnny Hummus has been about since the beginning of Johnny Hummus, was just spreading awareness, you know what I mean? So like just a social change, you know, getting more people to understand the plight of the Palestinians and how that relates to them, and, you know, how they can do this one place, they can do it somewhere else. So it's just a matter of, on my level, is that, and then also just, you know, trying to disrupt as much as possible, baby, because fuck, like, you know, that's the only way to get attention, it seems like, you know. So it's still hard because clearly, in the U.S., the government does not represent its people. So even if it's, even if you got every person in this country, you know, I mean, I would hope that if you got every person in this country on board, that something would change. But it is really difficult. So, I mean, right now, like I said, it's mainly about spreading information and just keeping up the good fight in every way we can.
Yeah. And I mean, I obviously see you out in the streets.
Yeah, I know you've been pretty busy yourself.
Doing that disruption situation.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Every time I see you out there, I'm like, hell yeah, man. Fucking real one, through and through. You've been out there more than me, to be honest, man. It's been hard. But I mean, I try to get out there as much as possible. But
yeah, I see you out there. I mean, but that's the thing is, like, you know, just thinking about what you're saying right now, it's like, I've definitely, like, had so many like ranges of like complete like delirium in my head, just like so like fucked up, you know what I mean? Just like so overwhelmed and like so just like so beat down. But then like then all these other moments, especially like when we're out there, and especially like I was listening back to some of this interview, and it's like I'm asking you, like in the interview, I'm asking you like what SEMA is about, and it's like
right.
I've spent so much time with SEMA in the last 2 months.
Total fucking legend.
Totally know what
real
SEMA's
one
about.
Through and through, strong as hell, truly an inspiration.
Quite possibly the realest out there.
Honestly, that's very true
in history. SEMA for president.
SEMA for president, for real, for real. What I will add to that is that like, damn, I lost my train of thought.
Well, I lost my train of thought, so I'll say too. Part of the thing for me though is like I'm just going out there as a person who does some organizing and a person who's trying to like support my friends and my community and try to do anything you can to stop a war, right? But like I have felt so fucked up, and it's like I am not affected by this at all,
right?
So it's like I can only imagine like the mental toll it's your people.
And that's what I mean. It's like the suffering is like truly incomprehensible, and it doesn't matter who you are or where you're from. Like that level of suffering is incomprehensible and in a lot of ways debilitating. But back to the last point of what I'm doing or what I want people to do is to be strong and resilient, because one thing I know about being a Palestinian is we're some of the most resilient people on the planet, if not the most resilient people on the planet. And with that said, is right now, it's way more important to be a pillar of strength in your community. You know what I mean? We can go home and cry, and there's nothing wrong with crying. You know, I've been crying like every fucking night. But at the end of the day, that's not fair. It's just not really fair when, you know, people are getting bombed. Children, thousands and thousands of children are dying. It's not fair. You know what I mean? Right now, it's imperative to be strong for your communities and show people what strength looks like and to carry that with you so people can be strong enough to have this revolution.
Yeah, and I feel like when you have been saying that explicitly on the internet, I see the way it resonates with people, you know what I mean? And you need those sorts of reminders and shit, you know?
To be weak is the easiest thing. And obviously, of course, like I could cry a river, you know what I mean? I could cry till there's no tears left, you know, in my body, you know, but what would that change? You know what I mean? So like, is there a time for that? Of course. But you know what will be way better is when we're crying tears of joy when Palestine is free. And that's what we need to focus on.
Hell yeah. Speaking of rivers, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be fucking free.
Damn right.
What's that mean to you?
To me, it means that the colonial borders, which are from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, will be free in the sense that equal rights for everyone there. That's not a caveat. There's no caveats in that statement. That doesn't imply Muslim, Christian, Arab, Jewish. There's no implications. It's verbatim in its meaning. It's free. That, you know, freedom, it's not, you know, there's no, I don't know, there shouldn't be any, you know, catch 22s to that. You know what I mean? So I don't understand how it's being co-opted to be this, like, I don't know exactly what they're calling it, but they're trying to like reverse genocide that statement, which doesn't really make any sense. But it's exactly what it means. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Palestine is for and will always be for the people. And that's all the people there. I know at this point, many of our peers have become very, very educated in the sense of like what the demographic looked like prior to the installation of the Israeli state. Like it was a multicultural society. Jerusalem was 50% Jewish. There was no problems with that. You know what I mean? There wasn't pogroms there. Like it was a very tolerant place. Like there's like historical basis that shows that Saladin was protecting Jews in Jerusalem. You know what I mean? So like the historical basis proves that that it was free. You were free to be who you wanted to be and practice whatever religion. And it's a very multicultural place. It's not even just like what I just stated. You know, there's like Druze and Armenians, and you know, there was always all sorts of people there. So to me, that's what it means. To me, it's a literal translation. You know what I mean? There's no allegory. It's not metaphorical. There's no, you know what I mean? I know it sounds like, oh, from the river to the sea. It sounds like a metaphor. It's not, you know, it's literal. So
it's so funny because I've had so many conversations in real life, in my fucking DMs, whatever, with people like about this topic or about similar topics, whatever. And I'm not going to ramble on like all my thoughts and theories, but you know, I something that I like end up saying to people a lot is like, I'm being fucking literal. You know what I mean? Like I'm like, they'll say that this shit, and then they try to do this like mental fucking intellectual gymnastics of like, well, and this fucking thing and this fucking thing, and this means the reverse genocide, like the fact that we've gone from reverse racism to reverse genocide to critical race theory and drag shows and whatever, and people are just so fucking brainwashed about like what everything is. But I'm like, I like have said to people, it's just like this is gonna be hard for you to grasp, but like maybe just decolonize your fucking mind.
That's exactly what it like, is too. That's exactly what it is.
And they're like, well, that's just a slogan. And I'm like, no, I'm being literal. Yeah. You are like thinking about this only in like a colonial power structure where people would have to kill other people in order to like have freedom.
Right.
Why don't you think about like what freedom is? Why don't you think about what power structures are? Why don't you think about like what nation states are or whatever? And I know why you don't, because these institutions that you were talking about have pushed the other fucking right. idea.
It's inherent. I mean, that's what, there's only one lens to look through that rationale through, and it's the inherent racism, you know, in the colonization in their mind. It's like, you still can only see Arabs and Muslims and Palestinians as subhumans. That's the only way that rationale, you assume as soon as the fucking doors open, they're going to be slaughtering the people that stood there. No, like, I mean, that's not that. There's a historical basis that proves against that too. Like for considering, okay, when slavery was abolished in the United States, this was a concern they had in the United States. It was like, oh, okay, well, they're going to want revenge. They're going to seek revenge. Well, historically, what we saw was nothing like that happened. Actually, what happened was lynch mobs from the current like white majority still. You know, the black people still had to be protected in this country after they were freed. You know what I mean? And it'll likely look similar, you know?
How and when will Palestine be free?
So, in my eyes, when, like, inshallah, like, in the next millisecond. But in the reality, when will it be free is when the occupation is totally ended. Palestinians are given freedom and rights, given their land back. Land back is the most critical part to me. And on top of that, reparations. And then allowing land back to not just the people in Gaza or the West Bank, but to the world, to the diaspora. You know, Palestinians, despite all this, were still the largest refugee population in the world, like 2 million abroad. Yeah, I mean, honestly, everyone wants to go home. You know what I mean? I'm sure you've all seen pictures. Palestine's gorgeous, man. It's a beautiful place. And like, I think people hear these ideas and they think they're these amazingly complicated thing. It's really not, you know, you just ending an occupation isn't complicated. You just end it, you know, and we saw what that looked like in apartheid South Africa, you know what I mean? And if anyone wants to argue about giving land back, what happened in the first place? Land was stolen. If you could steal land, you can give it back. It's not complicated.
You know, I know we talked about just doing three questions. I've already asked you like seven or eight or whatever, but
who's counting?
I'm just also curious, just because you were spending a little time with them. How's your family doing and what's their take on the whole fucking state of the world?
Me and my family don't necessarily agree on every aspect, which is normal, you know, and people will disagree, but everyone knows it's wrong. Like, it's disgusting. It's not even just wrong. Like, it's disgusting and deplorable, and there's never been any sort of disagreement about that. There's certain points of I don't know, contention, but it's not that. It's not that Palestinians, like, you know, people in Gaza don't deserve, you know, I mean, any normal human with empathy should be able to agree on these things. And, like, obviously my family's Palestinian, so obviously we agree on most things, you know. The things we disagree on are way more nuanced. But I don't know if we spoke about this in our last interview, but a lot of the points of contention aren't to do with the politics of the situation, but personal safety for various reasons. Like, we've seen the things that most Palestinians have seen from many of the sectors. You have a fear instilled in you that is really hard to conceptualize unless you are from a people who have been oppressed in such a way. Though I may have said this before because it's so important to me, but like reading The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin, like that's the only place I've ever been able to read how I was raised and the fear for your body and, you know, how it could be taken away from you. And there would be zero consequence. There'd be zero consequence to that. And that's why I was raised in such a way with this inherent need to protect myself at all costs, because it could be taken away so quickly. And for the most part, at least in the annals of history, with that was zero repercussion. So it's not for an older Palestinian person, dropping that mindset could be really difficult, you know what I mean? So the emphasis has always been keep your head down, just don't get noticed, you know, which obviously I've never obeyed. So
yeah, I feel like many of my like first gen Arab American friends have described like a totally similar type of conversation with their parents for obvious reasons. I do love that you said that, because I have like 5 pages left in If Beale Street Could Talk. I studied political science in college. I didn't study literature. And I guess maybe they don't teach James Baldwin in high school, or maybe just at my like rural ass hick high school.
They definitely did it in Florida.
But I've never read James Baldwin, and it is the like most beautiful writing. I never imagined writing could exist like that.
The man had a way with words for certain.
And I just picked up that book.
Oh,
that
really?
About to read that.
Dude, fucking be prepared to weep. But in the most beautiful way you could put words together, but also the most like harrowingly, you know, painful. Yeah, so there's a lot of pain in those books.
We stay weeping.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of reasons to cry, but just remember, like I said before, there's a time for that, and there's a time for strength. Never underestimate your own strength. And that, I think people, they want to keep people down, and part of that is not realizing your potential and what you can do as a person. And I can't give anyone all the answers. I don't have all the answers. All I can do is try to wake the people up who might have better answers, and together, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but together we are strong, and that's how we will free the world, not just Palestine.
We're going back in time. Catch us on the other side at part one or part two, depending on how you look at it.
The choice is yours.
Choice is yours. Again, free Palestine.
Allah ibarak al-jamia.
Johnny Hummus.
In the flesh.
Scene report.
In world-renowned hummus expert.
World-renowned hummus expert in the kitchen. I'm a little thirsty.
Drink some water, mate.
I'm going to open up this white label yerba mate soda.
Man, these things are delicious.
They really are. Wake me up a little bit, too.
Yeah, we'll put a little pep in your step.
How we doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I can't really complain, just day by day, you know?
Facts.
How about you, man?
Literally same. Just chilling, like running around.
So we can stay busy, I'm sure.
I saw your band play last night, but I went home earlier than you did. So, like, I'm I'm good.
Well, to be fair, this show started at midnight, so yeah. I don't blame you. For me, even, I'm just like, wow. Even though I stayed out regrettably late.
But how are you not going to stay out when you're like playing a gig, you know?
Yeah, I mean, rock and roll was never meant to be free, you know? The party, mm-hmm. the party rocker lifestyle is both vicious and beautiful.
Facts. Yeah, truer words. I feel like every once in a while, like when I'm not paying attention, I'm just like, facts.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, I heard you say like, facts a lot today. Yeah. But you know what? I find that validating. So.
Yeah. I mean, I am agreeing when I say it. That's for sure.
I used to work with a guy. He wouldn't say facts, but he'd say an alternative version. He'd say, you ain't lying.
Mm-hmm.
I like it's that the same thing as facts, but
that's so good. Yeah. I want to say it more.
Yeah, it's really good. But after a while, you're like, yeah, I'm not lying. Like, I'd be lying to you.
Someone outside of the show last night was saying that their favorite phrase was, "You got to be shitting me."
Oh yeah,
you got to be shitting me.
I mean, it's a great phrase. It's a great phrase.
Also, I feel you moved to New York City kind of recently, within the last like year or two.
Some year and change, yeah.
I feel like there's this funny thing where people move to New York and they like pick up the New York phrases like real quick. And there's like really subtle, like someone I was hanging out with, this was like a while ago, but she kept on saying like, what happened? And I was like, you know, what happened is like a New Yorker thing to say when you can't hear what they said. It's like, what?
Oh, yeah.
And she kept on saying, what happened? I was like, where are you from? And she was like, she was from like Pennsylvania or something. And I was like, how did you learn what happened so quickly? You've said it like 40 times in the last 3 minutes because she like couldn't hear what I was saying or something. Do you have a favorite New York phrase yet that you're saying?
You say that and I'm so guilty. In 5 minutes, like I picked up at least a lot of New York jargon. But yeah, someone will call me and I'll answer the phone. I'm like, you're, you know, like it just happens, you know?
I mean, when I spend a lot of time in Texas and like, within 2 days of Texas, I'm like talking real slow and like saying y'all.
You have a twang. You know, like, y'all. So, I mean, to be fair, even here, I hear people say y'all, but I love y'all. But because
I love y'all
it's,
too.
It's the best gender neutral way to address the world.
Yeah, I saw on someone's Twitter bio a while ago that was like they, them, y'all.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly.
Respect.
Yeah.
Backing it up a tiny bit, we got Johnny Hummus. World-renowned hummus expert.
The truth.
Drummer.
Guitar.
Bass also.
I've played bass in bands before, but I don't view myself as a real bassist because I feel like there's a lot of nuance to that instrument that's lost on a lot of people.
So most instruments in punk and metal bands. You ever sang in a band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sang in a band a while ago.
Of course.
It's not my favorite role in a band, to be honest. It's a little too vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on here and chatting with us.
I'm stoked, man.
And you know, I feel like we started talking about this like a year ago or something. So yeah. Here we are in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And we get to hear about hummus and punk and metal and whatever else. Yours.
What more could one ask for?
Yeah, that's what you got going on.
Yeah, man.
So who is Johnny Hummus?
Johnny Hummus is a man set to change the perception of hummus, at least in the Western world, because it is often bastardized and misrepresented. And for me, hummus is very important, especially as representation, because people just want to reap the fruits of the land and forget about the land and the people who harvested the fruits from said land. You know what I mean? It's just like, I don't know. I mean, in my perspective, like I grew up, I'm a 90s kid. I was in elementary school eating hummus and pita, and it wasn't even the kids clowning. It was like the teacher being like, what's that? Like, why do you care?
In Florida.
Yeah.
In Orlando.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in Orlando, Florida. What's so that? Like now, you know.
What's that, y'all?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like not none of your business. But
so the hummus was not a like thing in like the mainstream like white health food culture.
Yeah, it wasn't the phenomenon it is now. And it just feels like, you know, it kind of sucks when you, I don't know, you spent your life. It's not like, you know, this insane struggle, you know what I mean? It's not, but it does. Yeah. In the struggles that lurk behind the shadow of of that, like, yeah, it's like troublesome. So yeah, anyway, pretty much what really happened, why Johnny Hummus started, was Sabra Hummus gives a lot of money to organizations that I really don't like. Like, I really don't like. And I would still keep...
Which organizations?
I think the IDF, mainly. That's the number one I don't really like. But I would go to a homie's house. This is like a fucking supposed to be like some leftist punk rocker. You know, you go to their house and you open their fridge and sure enough, it's Sabra Hummus. And time and time again, this happened time and time again. I would go to the homie's house and be putting beer in the fridge because we're about to hang out. And it's like, yo, how many times do we have to have this conversation, dog? Like, for real, like... And be like, oh, it's BOGO. I'm like, I don't give a damn. Like, I'll make you hummus. You know what I mean? Like, so I just got to the point where I made the page and I didn't think anyone was going to give a shit. And they kind of didn't for a long time. But I always said if I got 400 followers, it wouldn't be embarrassing. Because, like, you know, it's kind of to be an internet personality and not have a following is just kind of, it's funny the validation in having, you know, a following compared to just being on the internet and not having a following. You're just a weirdo, you know what I mean?
Which sometimes happen to be the funniest accounts.
That's
like
true.
The homie who's, it's more of a like a Finsta with 200
absolutely
followers.
Yeah, like, these absolutely are the good. And that's, I was there for a long time, which I didn't really care. I was gonna do it anyway, you know what I mean? But it's still an interesting,
when you started at like what, like 4 or 5 years ago, something like
2019.
That. Yeah,
which I don't know how I've been doing it for 4 years, but it's not like I keep up with it a lot. I do it when I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not my job.
And what you got now, like 10,000 followers, something?
Something like that, like 11,000.
It grew steadily, or
no?
Or
it was happened? Dramatic, actually. Right before I moved to New York, when I decided to do a video of just roasting people's silly ass like tutorials, which, as I mentioned earlier, I kind of despise homeless tutorials, and I have no idea why people think they need to keep making them. Like, you know, if you go on the internet and just look up hummus videos, there's like thousands, if not tens of thousands. It's like, who is this for? Like, who needs all these ridiculous videos? It actually makes me really despise the internet, but that's probably a whole different thing. Because everyone, I mean, it might sound hypocritical to me to talk shit about people wanting to, like, make it on the internet or whatever the fuck. Because, I don't know, it's not really my end game, you know what I mean? But people, like, that's what they want. They just see a video, like, I could do that. Like, I learned a hummus tutorial. Now I'm going to make a hummus tutorial. This is the best recipe. These are the greatest secrets. Blah, 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 blah. It's like, yo, just make hummus and shut the hell up. You know what I mean? If you want to make hummus, I don't even really give a damn. But, like, you're trying to exploit hummus for your own personal gain? Nah, dog. That's where I draw the line, you know?
And are there, are there, like, any, like, Arab hummus tutorials that, like, you do fuck with?
There are some for sure. I still don't even really fuck with them because as far as the Arabs go, I really would rather them just gatekeep as hard as possible. You know what I mean? Because yeah, it's not the, you know, the problem with Arabs, right? As an Arab, right? They're just like open handed. Just they'll give it all away. You know, it's part of just like, you know, it's like there's other cultures like that too, where it's like what is mine is yours. You know, blah blah blah. But it's just different culturally. I don't think things always combine in the way you would imagine them. You know what I mean? So I feel like in a lot of even history of the region, how the European powers like took advantage of the region, it reflects it. I know it's a dramatic difference to talk about hummus versus like what happened in World War One, you know, with the Ottomans and the Allies. And, you know, it's dramatic, but it is indicative of the people.
Yeah,
which at the end of the day, I guess it wouldn't have really mattered. Like they would have taken the Middle East by force regardless, you know. So
yeah, I mean that stuff, I actually watched that Al Jazeera doc,
the World War One through Arab Eyes.
Yeah, that you've,
I really appreciate that you watched that, because of course, I mean, listen,
it was interesting.
I didn't even know before I came across that, I didn't know how we were involved, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And no one talks about it, because when they talk about the great wars, you know, all they, everyone talks about is England and France and Germany, and, you know, and not the people that were conscripted, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and that there seemed like there was like a lot of like resistance within that conscription too, and then it was like squashed
for sure. And I don't know if this is in that documentary. After that, the whole region had an insane famine. I mean, they talk about it in that, how like they lost 1/3 of the population in that time, and things only kind of got worse for the region. It's just, you know, it none of it worked. It's just Europe thought they could go there. One, they lied a lot and were like, yeah, we'll give you sovereignty if you fight against the Ottomans for us. And they did it, and they didn't get sovereignty. But
right, then it was the mandate or whatever that you had to set up your
Palestine. But
there were some other countries I thought too, though, maybe.
There were. You're right. Absolutely.
But they had to like do a European style government.
That's the thing, is they put upon them a sense of nationalism that didn't exist in the area. There was no nationalism, and that's also part of the reason why they had so much trouble fighting back, fighting for their own sovereignty and power, because to them it's just like, it doesn't make sense, you know? Like, they lived in their villages, their people were their villages. I mean, all of those countries, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, they're all Syria anyway. You know what I mean? So everyone was just Syrian, but that didn't really like mean that much, you know? It wasn't like some great union, you know? It just was the region, you know? And then everyone had their villages, and those were their people. So Europe comes in, makes these countries that of places that don't exist with people who don't mess with each other, and then expect them to, you know, you can't expect a unified force to come out of that, you know? So to this day, you could see things like, you know, Lebanon doesn't have a government, you know what I mean? Because it's a bunch of people who don't want to fuck with each other, you know? So
what do you know about like your family's history? Do you know about up to that era at all?
I don't know.
How far back do you know?
I know to like the 40s. I know some of the stuff before, but not as specific. But all my family was on both sides, was in Haifa. And then when the Nakba happened in 48, when the British gave Israel to Israel, I guess, they fled to Nazareth because it was safer. But those all ended up being in Israel proper anyway, which to me, regardless, is for the sake of the conversation. Obviously, to me, it's all Palestine, you know. But, so half the family still resides in Nazareth and the other half is still in Haifa. But I'm also, my grandma was Egyptian, and on my mom's side, I think there was some Lebanese people. So, which half of my grandpa's family fled to Lebanon in 48. And, I don't think he ever saw them again, because then the Lebanese Civil War happened and then they fled Lebanon. I mean, I think it was like 30 years later or something, but still, you know, because Lebanon like closed its borders and weren't taking any more Palestinian refugees, and you can't go from Israel to Lebanon. Like, so yeah, you never saw them again.
And wasn't I like, when I was digging through the Johnny Hummus archives, didn't I come across something that like, was it your grandfather who tried to like go back to his home?
Yeah.
And then there were like people who had already,
yeah, they already
been living there. Like Zionists had already started living in his house.
Yeah,
or something.
So like old Arab homes are all pretty big, you know, just like the style with like open courtyard and stuff. So there was like, wasn't like a lot of rooms. It was like four rooms. And then every room had been occupied by a whole settler family, and he was able to pay them off. But
so each like bedroom.
Yeah, better. Yeah. The
so they're all like the, room, they're the, all like roommates, like the, chilling out.
The crazy thing is the building had been bombed as well, so the roof had been collapsed. So they're living in this collapsed building, but he literally rebuilt it after buying them out. Because he was trying to flee.
What city was that in?
This is in Haifa. He actually, they owned that home for a long time. They sold it probably 20, 30 years ago. But yeah, like he tried to flee to Lebanon too, but it was too late. They had closed the borders. But that's why his sisters went, and he tried, but at that point he didn't have a choice but to turn around.
I'm curious about what the hummus scene was like abroad for you, and what it's been like abroad for you. Because, like, you know, you talked
I just know that you went to Haifa kind of recently.
Yeah.
And ate some hummus there. But also, like, you know, I feel like you've already mentioned that this project, or I don't know how you describe Johnny Hummus, person, project, persona.
I guess so, yeah. Whatever it is. It's a project.
Project, like, you know, is that like a... It's like obviously like a little bit of a more of a critique of like Western ideas about hummus or something. This is not a question really at this point.
I think I know what you're saying.
But like what's the like there's world A and world B or something. And you live in both.
Yeah, I mean like so I mean hummus isn't something you think about. You know what I mean? Like obviously like the top tier hummus spots are respected and known. You know, you go to any city and they'll tell you where you get hummus, you know? Like if you watch the videos I was talking about in Nazareth, there's like three joints in Nazareth that everyone knows. That's like those are the spots. And then Haifa has a bunch, and there's like some modern young chefs like doing really cool things out there too. But even there, you know, sometimes it's just always on the table. It's not like something it's not taken for granted, but it's like having butter on the table. You know what I mean? This is the closest thing I can imagine, you know, it's something you put on bread. But here, yeah, I mean, a lot of my problems is just like the Western ideology anyway. I mean, it has nothing to do with the West as much as just like capitalism. And I don't hate to say that because I do believe that everything bad is rooted in capitalism. But
fair point.
Yeah, but it just makes everything so exploitative and commodify everything. You know what I mean? It's just, can we sell it? Like, let's sell it, you know? Let's sell it. And it boils my blood, you know? I think it destroys the value of things, you know? If you just commodify everything, it becomes worthless somehow, to me anyway. But I think most people, a lot of my peers would agree. And I think if said in other words, like if I didn't say capitalism, most people would agree with the sentiment, you know. But mm-hmm. as soon as you throw like a label, especially one that's so anti-American, you know, people get upset, all riled up, you know.
I feel like when I, like the first times that I went to Europe when I was like in my early 20s, I was so so relieved about how like it was like normal to be anti-capitalist in some way, that it wasn't like, oh, the second you said that or the second you said socialism, it was like, well, this is what I think about that. It's like, no, you could actually like,
yeah,
talk about different ideas.
Yeah,
like, I don't know how much of the world is like that, but to just be like, well, out of this place.
Yeah, I know what you mean in the sense of they're more open to ideas. Obviously, Europe is also not perfect in many ways, especially depending on what country you're speaking of specifically. But in contrast to American culture, in which a lot of it has to do with being reactionary rather than critically thinking, which I think people are kind of programmed to be like that here because it suits the purpose of, I don't know, what to once again... to commodify everything. Like if you don't ask questions, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything, you know? So I don't know. In Europe, I think they are more open to ideas and general overall welfare of the people who live around them.
Yeah.
I think there's obviously a lot of room for improvement over there, but in contrast to what we're dealing with in the United States, where, you know, you can't just go to a hospital, they'll just let you die, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a more advanced version of the like colonial capitalism that we have here, like, yeah. It's like, oh yeah, we figured the part out where you're supposed to go to the hospital.
Yeah,
we're still gonna like keep our power, and we're gonna have like a lot of right-wing sentiments and a lot of racist and xenophobic sentiments, but like we got like the simple things out. We just don't even have the simple things. Yeah,
the most basic like welfare, like versus here where they don't give a shit.
Yeah, yeah, we're just as idiotic as a people could ever be. Like,
and I don't blame anyone like as an individual. I mm-hmm. do think it's systemically set up to be this way, and just the indoctrination is like palatable. You know what I mean? But I don't think people, the veil here is very, very thin. But I don't think people want to see it. I think it's like cognitive dissonance because their life's a lot simpler if they just buy into the bullshit. Like, you know, it's like you don't have to feel bad if you just say America, you know? Why would you feel bad, you know?
Yeah. I'm curious, like, when was the first time that you went to the Middle East and the first time that you ate hummus in the Middle East? And also, like, what you've said things on your page about, you know, hummus being like being a story of people, and like how did those sort of experiences outside of the United States like inform to you like what that story is?
I was very privileged, especially for someone who's Palestinian, to be able to visit my family a lot. When I was a kid, we would go to Nazareth every summer. I'd be there for 2 or 3 months a year. So I spent a lot of time there, which is a privilege. It's there's more to explain there because the type of the Palestinians there are, there's the A, B, and C region. So I'm what they would call Arab 48, which is the Palestinians who still live in Israel, which I hate to say, but that's, you know, what it, you know,
for the sake of the conversation.
For the sake of the conversation. So I was able to go a lot, which many Palestinians, they cannot go, you know? So that, to say that really quick, is a huge privilege, and I'm blessed to have had that. So as far as remembering my first experience with hummus, I can't, you know, that's part of the point too, though.
It was just on the table.
Yeah, it's like, you know, what makes me a world-renowned hummus expert is that it was always a part of my life. It wasn't like, it's not like, I didn't have to discover it. It was there. It was always there. And it's all, and that's, it doesn't matter, like, if you're eating with Arabs, or at least in the Levant, there's always hummus. There's just very easy to take for granted because it just exists. So I never really thought about it, you know? I never thought about it. It was just part of my life. And that's why I get upset, you know? But as far as, like, how it's a story of a people, I like to think of, as I said earlier, I mean, food in a lot of ways is a representation. And people have a lot of arguments, you know what I mean? Like, okay, tomatoes didn't get to Europe until the 15th century. You don't really, I mean, you think of a lot of those cultures, like, sure, I think of like tomato Europe, you know, tomato Europe, potato Europe. But I know things change. I know cuisine is global.
But tomato Europe is like fancier Europe than potato Europe.
It's just like the southern part of Europe.
Yeah, like Italy versus the fact you would
say
Ireland.
Exactly. But the fact that you could say that and you associate a part of Europe with tomatoes when they're not from there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The point is, I understand food changes, takes different identities, whatever. But for me, particularly with hummus, and particularly knowing, like, you know, the context is everything, you know, the context of the region where, like, people aren't represented, they're being misrepresented, and they're, you know, they're killing children on a daily basis, you know. Yeah, it's like not quite the same as like someone being like tomato marinara sauce is Italian, you know what I mean? But it is to me like, you know, I don't think people spend too much time. Most people I know don't spend too much time thinking about their ancestors. And for a lot of reasons, I mean, most people, you know, aren't so straight up. Like, I'm straight up Arab. You know, if I did a genealogy test, like, it's going to be like Middle East, North Africa. You know what I mean? So, like, for me, yeah, it's like a direct line to my ancestors. You know what I mean? It is a story. And that's why I like food. I think food is the one of the few things where you enjoy it and it's culturally relevant. You know what I mean? It can be. So yeah, like for me, like I can't ever talk to my ancestors. I'll never meet them. For the most part, I'll never know anything about them other than the food they passed down and the stories and whatnot, you know, random stories. But the food is important to me. It's really cool to eat something that I know someone 1,000 years ago was eating too, you know. That may say sound silly to a lot of people, and I am like that I'm like I don't know the right word, I don't know the right word, but
it's not nostalgic.
I guess it's not nostalgia, but something like along
deeper those lines. Than nostalgic.
Yeah, maybe. Like needlessly deep or whatever the word would be for that. But to me, I mean, that's just who I am. You know, I can't see things other ways. You know.
Yeah. Who taught you how to make hummus?
My mom. My mom makes fire hummus. I wish I could make it as good as her. For some reason. Mom's touch always kind of goes a little harder than my touch. I mean, it's kind of an experience thing. You make it all the time, you know. But it was really funny because we went back home not that long ago, and she was like, you know what? My hummus is better than most of the hummus I had there. I was like, you're right. But not, like, you know, out of her sisters, which, you know, there's always a competition to see who's, like, the best cook or whatnot. Like, unspoken competition. But,
like an actual competition.
Yeah,
like
all right. Yeah.
Trophies all right. And medals. Today,
today's
and stuff.
Ingredient is.
Yeah. No. The timer's on.
Yeah, yeah. No. Yeah, so I learned it from my mom. She, you know, if I make her hummus, dude, she's so critical. It's not, sometimes it hurts my feelings. I'm like, wow. Like, all right.
Is she happy that you're making it? Or she don't care?
She does not care.
Yeah.
At all.
What is false hummus? You've touched on this.
That's a tough question. The one phrase that way. So, well, okay. So there's two, in my eyes, there's two realms. There's the hippie bullshit, which is like usually inedible. Like you go to like the vegan restaurant, you get the hummus there and it's just like, it feels like mashed potatoes, but chickpeas. You know what I mean? It's like, doesn't even resemble hummus. It looks like a scoop of ice cream. Like, you know what I mean? It's like the person had never even had real hummus. You know what I mean? Someone was just like, this is the ingredients to hummus. I'm just going to combine all of them and call it hummus. You know what I mean? And then there's the more, I don't think those people are intentionally, I don't think that anyone's trying to be evil, you know what I mean? But I think there's some things are a little bit more heinous than others. And when it comes to the other realm, where it's food, like just straight up, like, you know, Zionists saying that hummus is like Israeli or something like that, which is like controversial to say. Like I say that and now I'm like, damn, like, am I going to get arrested now? You know what I mean? But, it's just kind of crazy to me. And there's a lot of that in Brooklyn where you go to these like fancy, like Israeli chef, blah, 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 blah. And like, you know what? I wouldn't care. I wouldn't care if the situation isn't what it is. And the context, like I said before, is everything. Like, I don't think anyone owns food. You know what I mean? But in this case, when like these people are getting like, you know, killed and you're just taking it and making it your own, saying that this is Israeli. It's like, it's just kind of, it's just heinous, you know? So to me, that's all false hummus anyway. And like these fools, like they learned from like, you know, who taught them? Arabs. Like even if you go to Israel now, like you're in Israel proper, everyone eats at the Arab joints. Like those are the everyone knows it. And there's like a line and it's mixed Jews and Arabs. You know what I mean? Everyone knows where the good is. You know what I mean? And it's not the Zionist chefs, you know, no offense to them, you know, well, actually, I don't know, whatever, that's besides the point. But yeah, so to me, that's all false hummus.
Yeah, that's a good rundown of false hummus.
That's how I see it, and I am a world-renowned hummus expert, so.
When's the first time that you got mad about hummus?
The first time I got mad about hummus? I mean, to backtrack, probably, like I said, I mean, those memories of being in elementary school and literally teachers saying stuff to me. I mean, that was probably the first time, but it wasn't so, I don't know. I didn't really understand what was happening at the time.
Yeah, not as
conscious. I was mainly mad that I was being made to feel different because of hummus. You know what I mean? But it wasn't because of the hummus. But probably... to touch on something else I also mentioned earlier, when I got really mad and when I started doing the page is like when my own friends weren't listening to me. And that's what really bothered me. Because then I found, like, it didn't really matter what I said. No one would listen. If a white person said it to them, then it was true. But me, as someone who's so deeply involved and impassioned, you know, they don't take me seriously, you know, and it just made me really, really, really mad. You know, I was pretty oblivious to most of it in the first place. I wasn't oblivious, but like, I wasn't thinking about store-bought hummus, you know what I mean? Because I would never buy store-bought hummus. It's just, why would I do that? It's the easiest shit to make on the fucking planet, if you know what you're doing anyway, you know? But for the people who know me, they know that I'd be mad. So I've been mad.
You stay mad?
Well, sometimes, depends. But yeah, I have a hard time, I don't know, letting go of things like that. And that makes me who I am. And I guess I wouldn't be Johnny Hummus if I wasn't that way. But it's funny to see how the world at large views me versus people who know me who are just like, oh, this motherfucker again. It's like, yeah, I'm here. I'm not tired. You know, I'm not going to be tired until they put my ass in the ground. So deal with it.
What else do you get mad about?
I don't know. Everything. Capitalism. Capitalism. It's fucking just, I don't know, man. The world's such an insane place. The living life in general is like, it's all just like this gauntlet, you know, like there's that, I don't agree with a lot of the shit Adam Curtis says, but there's that Adam Curtis documentary, Hypernormalization, right? The title is the point here. I don't really care about the documentary, but you have to normalize so many things just to exist. And I have to live in this country where I have to pay taxes that in turn turn into bombs that are bombing my own people. Yeah, that shit makes me fucking mad, dude. And it's all related, and it's just, it sucks that, it doesn't suck, it just seems like such a scapegoat statement to say capitalism is the problem. But it's, where does that come from? I don't think people are, like, just, people aren't doing things because they want to kill people. Or, I mean, in this country anyway, the government is just selling weapons because that's how they make money. They don't give a shit about anything, you know what I mean? As long as they get their fucking $7 billion in return on weapons, they don't give a fuck who's dying, you know what I mean? So, I mean, yeah. They don't give a fuck. Their own people are fucking dying. There's people dying on the fucking street. There's not clean water in fucking Flint. But they can give fucking $10 billion to fucking a fascist state. You know what I mean? So I stay mad because, like, I'm not willing to normalize shit like that. You know, and that's, like, the world you're expected to live in. So, yeah, it's hard because being mad isn't, like, it's not good for you. You know what I mean? It's not you. It hurts you, but What am I supposed to do? I refuse to live my life on my knees. You know, even if it fucking kills me, I refuse to be like that.
I mean, it makes me think of even something we were talking about earlier in this conversation about, like, America being this such, like, infantile, like, shit version of, like, what the world can be and what capitalism is. Of just, like, you know, every once in a while you, like, just take a step back and remember that there's, like, healthcare companies that make money off of people dying or getting medicine or not medicine or treatment or not treatment. There's prisons that are privately owned. There's detention centers for immigrants that are privately owned. It's like, it's all like an industry of death everywhere you look. Guns, like every single little tiny thing, it's like it's all fucked, you know. And it's just like, yeah, it's hard to not stay mad about that sort of thing.
It's all big money, baby.
Yeah,
and it's despicable.
It's despicable. speaking of things that aren't so despicable, I would be remiss not to ask you a little bit about punk rock.
Punk rock, baby.
Or whatever, metal or aggressive genres of music.
Extreme music for extreme people.
Exactly. Like I said, I saw one of your bands, Pure Terror, play last night. Just to start, do you conceptualize your music in a similar way that you conceptualize your thoughts about hummus?
It's interesting for me because I'm not in any of the bands I'm in right now, I'm not the lyricist, so it's to put ideas into it like that isn't necessarily what I'm doing in music, but the people I do make music with are pretty on par with my thoughts, so I trust them to represent us in that way. But in turn, Pure Terror is a really special band to me because everyone, it's an all-Arab band, which really not many of those in the world. And it's, for me, even if we weren't making music, having an excuse to hang out with them once a week, you know, for a couple hours is like some of the most fun I have. So for me, it's like an important project. But beyond that, we do make music that I like, you know, and it's fun. It's really fun. They're just such a good group of people, and they mean the world to me. So it's really fun.
Yeah, I mean, even like hearing you say that, and you know, seeing y'all play last night, I'm like thinking about it and sitting here and having this conversation where it's like I've sat at the same table and had long conversations with one of your bandmates, Nader, and interviewed him at length in multiple different scenarios, and I'm like, he's one of the smartest, dedicated people I know, and I see a sincere similarity between the way that you guys discuss some of these issues, and then I'm like, well, what else do those other people in that band have to say, because they all seem pretty fucking cool too. It's like
they're pretty awesome. Yeah, man, they're both amazing. Danny and Seema's a fucking legend, so is Danny. And I don't know, I mean, Seema's always doing the most, like, politically out of everyone in the band. They're the most action. Nader, man, that dude's a legend. And it's so funny for me as an Arab, like, if you will, punk, you know, not knowing him and knowing him. I've known him for much longer than he's known me, let me put it that way, because he blew up for the wrong, maybe that's not the right word. But anyway, yeah, like, you know, when Haram kind of popped off, everyone was like, yo, you got to listen to this. Like, everyone I knew was like, hey, you need to check this out. Like, yo, like, this is for you. You know what I mean? And he became this, like, Arab punk poster boy, which I don't really know if anyone really, you know, who really saw him like that wasn't Arab. Like, I guess to most people, that's what they saw. But it's so interesting that I'm in multiple bands with him. I live with him. And 3 years ago, if you asked me if I was going to be in bands with Nader Haram, I'd be like, what? And I mean, and at this point, I love him like a brother. So we're doing a lot of stuff together.
So are you, did you just slightly informally break some news right here on Scene Report?
Yeah.
Playing in multiple bands with Nader from the band Haram.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am now playing guitar in Haram, which is really exciting for me and insane. It's just like really not precedented. I didn't expect that. It's cool though. It's been really cool. It's going to be a while anyway, so I don't know when this is coming out, but if anyone's listening to this, don't get too excited. It's going to be a while. I'm also in another band with him too though. So it's funny. We're in three bands. Yeah, the Shayateen.
What's that band?
It's like a heavy metal kind of band. It's me, him, and Troy from the Holy Mountain, which is a throwback name, but the band went ripped.
Florida, right?
Florida, yeah, Tampa.
Yeah, and if I don't know, people listening to this might not know who Haram is, but I think you kind of talked about it a little bit. But
I mean, it was, for anyone who doesn't know, it was like the first band that most of anyone heard where the vocalist was doing Arabic vocals. But then also, of course, all the notoriety came from all that other shit that I don't think he even likes talking about anymore, like the FBI and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Which I can understand, you know. I think he's focused on the future, which is exciting because I'm also part of that future. So,
yeah. And what is, like, I guess, like, what, you know, like you said earlier, you moved to New York like year and change ago. What were the differences between like playing music in Orlando, playing music in New York?
Oh man, let me tell you, the differences are fucking huge.
Yeah. All right. What are they?
Playing in Florida. I'm from Orlando. Playing in Orlando, Florida. The scene there is like an amalgamation of many things because it's by necessity. You can't just have a raw punk scene in Orlando. You know, there's like one raw punk band, there's an indie band, and there's like a metal band, and they'll play a show together. And that's a show. And honestly, I love a variety show. And here it's a little more privileged. You know, the major cities, like, it's like I only listen to raw punk. I only listen to street punk. I only listen to atmospheric black metal. And these are the only, and you can go to those shows exclusively and go to like one show a week, you know? But beyond that, like, at times you go to a local show in New York, it's like 400 people. You know what I mean? That doesn't, you know, like you could get like maybe 200 people at a local show once a year in Orlando, you know? But it's just interesting. The other thing about playing music in Florida is everyone wants to leave Florida. So I've seen so many iterations of like punk happen and like spontaneously. And it's so cool. It's honestly really cool to say that I lived through like three generations of like scenes in Florida, you know, and some were better than others, but it's really not the point, you know, the point that punk, no matter what, spontaneously occurs. Cause like, truthfully, I saw two exoduses of just all my friends leaving and for good reason, you know, it's not the easiest place to live. You always like have to, it's not like, you know, at the end of the day, we're still in the United States, but in a lot of ways, as far as like just being the person you want to be, or not want to be, but the person you are, it's a lot harder to do in Florida. You know, it's much harder to do. And if you want to do music and stuff like that, you come to New York, you're in the limelight. No one, like I can go off about a million Orlando bands and no one would know what the fuck I was talking about. You know what I mean? Bands that I loved, bands that ripped harder than many bands I've seen elsewhere. You know what I mean? But they just, coming from a place like Orlando, it's not, you know, it's hard. And like, I don't know, people do things for different reasons. It's not like I ever made music to like, you know, if I wanted to like blow up, I wouldn't be playing hardcore or like metal, you know, mm-hmm. I would have chosen differently. But the having a little bit of recognition, like, you know, people like being affected by your music and stuff, it's cool. You know, it's like, I think it's cool. But I mean, that's not even specific to Florida, though, because a lot of people, you know, come in Miami. I mean, Miami's a huge city. If you play music in Miami, you know, people know your bands, you know? It's just the matter of proximity and the amount of people who are into those things that can relay those things to other people who like those things, you know? So it's just harder in a city like that. And I think that's like a lot of cities in the country, you know, small cities where people have to really build their own scenes, which, talking to people here, you know, I get a lot of perspective too, because you come to New York and you think the Ramones are from here, like all that shit, fucking CBGB, all that shit, you know, like you think that punk just exists. But talking to the people who kind of built the scene that we're in now, it's like, oh, you had to build this too. Like, no one, it wasn't like handed to you, you know, you had to find the venues, you had to start the bands, you had to, you know, the essential work to make a scene happen, you know. But with that said, I think something gets lost when scenes do get handed. And the beauty of the smaller cities in the South and the Midwest is those people go so hard. They go so hard because it's all they have, you know. There's no distractions. There's one show, like, maybe once a month, you know. Everyone's at that fucking show. And everyone's going fucking hard. You know, it's not a bunch of jaded fucking pricks. And I'm not saying that about here, you know. Here, it's honestly, I was honestly pretty surprised by how welcoming and inclusive the scene has been.
Yeah, I mean, I remember first moving to New York City from upstate New York and going to shows in Albany and stuff. And I was like, it's the same thing up there where it's like you have a rocker band and a hardcore band and like a street punk band or something on one show, but all the exact same things. I'm just like, oh, there's this just like way more people. But like, even, you know, I was like immediately like missing the like weirdness of the upstate stuff where it wasn't so like defined
right.
as it can be here. And then like, yeah, just, I don't know, something that you just said just like makes me laugh a lot. Cause like I feel like there's this funny thing that happens in the punk scene here too, where like people who are new to New York City think that they're supposed to be kind of like standoffish and like rude because they think like New York is like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it like takes them like a year or two to be like, oh, New York is actually like an extremely friendly place.
It really is.
Interpersonally.
Like, it really is.
You talk to all sorts of different people all day long. So yeah, there's this level of like coldness and it's not like you're like in the South and like nodding and saying hello to people when you walk by them on the street, but the person who's sitting next to you who's on the subway and like having something going on, like you're probably like having a conversation with that person if you're like of the means to be able to do that, if whatever, you know what I mean? Like there's this funny, like it's like such a, I work in immigration stuff, you know, and it's like, we're always talking about like New York being like a welcoming place for immigrants because that's like happened since the beginning of this city.
It's the story of New York.
It's the story of New York. And it's like, it's true on every level. It's not just, you know, there's contradictions there, but like interpersonally, it's a very welcoming place.
I mean, fundamentally, it's a city of people. You know, that's what it is. It's not a huge area. There's a lot of people though. And that's, I think in a sense, people are more readily socialized in that way because you are surrounded by people, you know, and of all walks of life, which is great.
And, you know, screaming fuck you at somebody who like cuts you off in their car is also just like, also like saying hello.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, that's just the way it is. And like, you're upset about that? No, that's just like, fuck you.
Dude,
like,
it's literally the duality of man, dude.
Yeah. It's a wild city. It's a wild city for that duality, for sure. And like, speaking of cities and you know, the duality of man, I mean, I think that like something that even just like casually, you know, consuming the content that you make as Johnny Hummus, I just find it really like, I don't know. There's something about even the stuff we're talking about now where it's like you go and eat hummus in like different places, you know? And like, I feel like that idea of like it being like a story of people, like you're even like, you know, you had that video where you were eating hummus in like Birmingham, Alabama, and you were like across the street from MLK where he did like Letter from a Birmingham Jail or something.
Birmingham Jail.
You know, it's like there's this thing where it's like, I don't know, I guess it's just like a punk thing or something, but like where you like, when people start like making stuff themselves about like food or culture or something, you end up like exploring all these other things. And like, I feel like just from like a physical geographical perspective, like you're going to places that have these like deep histories and you're like finding this like other way to like interact with that history.
It is interesting, to be honest, because I don't know, anytime I go to a city, I always read about it because I don't know, I'm just interested, you know, I want to know, like and you know, the South, people like to shit on the South all the time. The South has a rich history, you know, and not all of it, obviously some of it's like particularly fucking heinous, but outside of that, you know, finding where I meet and the messages that I want to convey to the world and finding those messages around me, like intrinsically into the place I'm in, you know, it's I don't know the word to describe how it feels, but it just feels like it makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, but it is also interesting to be in a place like Birmingham and then find something that represents my culture and they do it well. You know what I mean? But I never would have known that there was I don't own being Lebanese. I'm barely Lebanese, but it's funny to go to Birmingham, Alabama and find out, oh, there's a huge Lebanese community there. You know what I mean? So that's like also the beauty of the traveling, you know, traveling is so important because you go talk to locals, learn more about the city that you never would have known, you know, hot, big Lebanese population is not on the Birmingham Wikipedia, you know, not that that's like the highlight of the fucking city, but for me, it's like interesting, but there's a lot to be learned. There really is. There's a lot to be learned. And at the, to the point of what I was trying to convey in that video, I mean, my, I'm talking about hummus, right? Usually, that, I mean, at least it seems like the focal point is hummus. But really, you know, it's about bigger. It's always going to be about the bigger issues and people's rights and just trying to strive for a better world. Not to give myself too much credit because I think it's mainly lost on a lot of people. But that's what I'm trying to do, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Mexico City like 4 or 5 years ago, like kept on going back.
Love that city.
Me too. And it took me a minute to even know that, you know, Al Pastor tacos were made by Lebanese immigrants in Mexico City. Had no idea. I was eating that best food in the world for like so many times.
I think it's like becoming more popular knowledge that is descended from that. But my favorite part of that is like, it's called the Shepherd. The Al Pastor is the Shepherd. It's because everyone from the Levant, like, they're all like, you know, my ancestors, they were sheep herders. You know what I mean? And so it's just, I love that that's what it's called. It's not called, you know, Levantine meat. It's called the Shepherd. So sick.
I want to pivot from sheep to beef.
Let's go.
And just quickly ask you, like, you got any like big outstanding internet or otherwise beef right now that you want to let the world know about? Because I thought that one with the vegan chef guy was pretty good.
Chef Ben. Yeah, I mean, that guy, I think he was trying to send an olive branch and it just kind of backfired. But then I kind of got put on blast by some Zionist influencers, which kind of bothered me because they totally misconstrued everything I said to the benefit of making me to be some quote-unquote mudslinger. And then they tried to convince me that hummus was in the Torah, but they were talking about something called homez, which is vinegar in Hebrew. So I wasn't really buying that. To that point.
And who are these
influencers? I don't know. I don't even care.
In the United States?
One was in the United States, one was in England. But like, I don't care at all. Especially like, if you want to say some shit about me, just at least use the shit I said. Don't be fucking saying, I didn't say in the specific video, I didn't say anything. I never talked about Jews as a people. The only thing I even referred to was an ethno-fascist state, which is, for me, easier than saying Israel because things get flagged real quick when you start talking like that. So, like, I don't know. I mean, there's this misconception that Judaism and Zionism are the same thing, and they're not. They're just not. And Jews have lived peacefully in the region with Arabs forever. You know, yeah, they were there. So, like, to their point, they're like, oh, this is also Jewish food. Yeah. But it's not Zionist food. And it still was like, it's still Arabic to the point I was making, like, hummus is an Arabic word. That's for a reason. It's because it's Arabic food, you know? So, like, you can argue all fucking day, but it seems like the proof's in the fucking pudding, you know? And the pudding is hummus, which is Arabic, you know? So, like, I don't know what's even the argument. You know what I mean? You're using something like that to validate a state that's only existed for 70 years. Like, come on, dude. Like, find something better than that. You know, fucking vinegar. Like, there's no vinegar in hummus. There's no, it's not relevant. But, like, to that point, you go to Nablus, right? Nablus is in Palestine. It's in the West Bank. And in those mountains, there's Jews been living in those mountains for 4,000 fucking years. You know what I mean? They don't fuck with anyone. You know, they live their own solitary lives. And I would never take that away from them. I don't know what the fuck they eat, you know? But the point is, they exist, and they exist peacefully because Nablus, like, to the Israeli state, is known to be a breeding ground for terrorism. It's like, all right, really? Why aren't they fucking with the people in the fucking mountains behind them? You know what I mean? Like, it's just... Anyway, I'm wandering off the point. Yeah, there's a little bit of beef, but, you know, when you're Johnny Hummus, you have to expect this kind of thing, you know? Putting myself on the line. which sucks. As a Palestinian, there's a lot of fear there. I mean, I was raised with a lot of fear. I was told to, my name's John, you know, and it's not a coincidence. I was told to tell people I was Greek, you know. There's like the instilled fear of like, you never know what's going to happen. You can, all, everything will be used against you. Everything. So like, it doesn't seem like I'm like in the fucking great peril, but in the, at the end of the day, there's a lot to be worried about. And it's like this James Baldwin-esque fear that's like just instilled to you, you know.
How do, given your title, the world-renowned hummus expert, how do, like, what sort of reactions do you get to that title, and do they differ based on people's, like, ethnicity, based on people, where they grew up in the world? Like, what's people's takes on the title?
The takes are interesting. Some people laugh at me like I'm a fucking idiot, which is the worst take. That one, that's the only one that bothers me. And the ones, the takes abroad, often the take abroad, like in the Middle East and whatnot, is like, what? Like, why? Like, what are you talking about? Like, because hummus is such an everyday thing and they don't know the horrors that exist on the other side of the Atlantic. Yeah. I mean, here, I think people, in a lot of ways, people think I'm funny, which I don't really know why. I'm just me, which is mad, which I guess people always thought that was funny. But I guess, to be honest, I'll take that. If that's how I get people to think about things, maybe they'll chuckle a little bit and then they'll set in. You know, I don't mind. You know, humor can be a real powerful tool. But as far as, those are pretty much the only takes. This dude's a fucking idiot. And then, I don't understand why you're doing this. And then, the best scenario where they're like, huh, this guy's kind of funny. But what's he saying, really? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there is, you have a level of, you do have a level of humor in deliveries are not dryness or whatever, but it's
the UK loves me.
Yeah. Kind of last question, and then I'm going to let you say if there's anything else you want to say.
Sure.
What what's your goal for hummus?
Yeah, that's a heavy hitter. I don't think, I wish I knew how to answer that, because I'm just, the way I operate, I don't know what the end game is. I really don't know how, when Johnny Hummus's job will be done. I really don't. It's like a matter
when of, hummus will finally be out.
I guess the end game is Palestine's free, which it's not like, am I going to be responsible for that? Probably not. You know what I mean? So I'll do my little silly work where I yell about hummus on the internet so people can at least be a little more cognizant of what they're doing and eating, and like how to, not to keep coming back to this point, that food is representation, especially when people really need to be represented. You know what I mean? When the world turns your back on you, you know, anything you have is important to you. So I can't truthfully say when the job will be done. But I hope one day. I hope one day I don't have to do this.
That's fair. anything else that you want to say or talk about?
Oh, man. No, I don't think so. I mean, I got a show on Monday. Not this Monday, next Monday. Well, that won't matter when this comes out.
Yeah, mad far in the past.
No, I don't know. But you know what I will say? I'm going to plug my own hummus, because I'm going to start ramping up to selling hummus locally in Brooklyn and the city. So buy my fucking hummus. I'm going to donate some of the money to some organizations that I haven't exactly decided just yet who. So bear with me on that. But I guarantee you it's going to be a very luxurious experience that you won't soon forget.
Pick up or delivery?
Probably pick up. Deliveries.
Yeah, that sounds rough.
But we'll see. Maybe the people want to see what the a picture of the truth.
Well, I can't wait to eat that.
I'll get you some for sure.
I'm gonna come pick that up. Johnny, John,
however,
thanks for coming on,
dude. Thank you so much. It was great. Appreciate you. I appreciate you, man.
We'll see you next time.
Yeah, man, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Season 1, Episode 1 of Scene Report. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast. I know podcast people say that a lot, but if you could actually rate, maybe 5 stars, review, what did you like, what did you not like, subscribe so it shows up in your feed the next time we have an episode come out. It actually makes a big difference in building our audience if you could take those simple 3 steps. And while you're at it, if you'd throw us a follow, maybe even a comment on Instagram. The handle is protest, letter N, survive. That's protest, N, survive. That's the name of my old podcast. That's currently my handle. If you have a contact at Instagram to try to help me figure out as a verified Instagram account how to change it to Scene Report Podcast, having issues over there. While you're on Instagram, if you could share this episode, if you could tell your friends, if you could tell your family, if you think they might be interested in this, trying to grow this thing on a grassroots level with a little bit of support from my friends. For now, Instagram is the only social media account we're going to be active on. I am your host and producer, Reed Dunley. The show's executive producer is Ash Tyner. This episode was associate produced by Connor Williams. The theme music for the show was written and recorded by Kyle Seeley with a little assist from Hart Seeley. The logo is by Kyle Seeley of the band Sheer Mag. You might notice a similarity to that band's logo. The Scene Report canvas banner was made by myself and Elvis Metcalf with a little assist from Miles Shelton and Ash Tyner. Once again, thanks, Johnny.